Stay tuned for The Cinema Clash as Maryland-based critics Charlie Jewell and Hannah Buchdahl debate the merits of new releases, from the mainstream movies that Hannah tends to favor to obscure foreign films that Charlie likes to champion. It's free-flowing, unedited conversation with an occasional wine wager. Two very different perspectives, one entertaining podcast. Let the clash begin.
Hello and welcome to another foreign stream edition of the Cinema Clash. I'm Hannah Buchdahl of chickflix.net, sharing the remote co-host duties with Charlie Jewell of charliejewell.com, who warned me that this week he wants to kick things off with a song. Take it away, Charlie.
Okay. Thank God July is over, Hannah. Thank God July is over. And this month, which is only 31 days long, as many as half the months are of the year, will end with 28 days over 90 degrees. That smashes the old record of 90 degree days in a single month in Washington, D.C., which was 25, set in July of 2011. It was so hot this month. So hot. And now it's over. I can't believe I'm actually saying, welcome, August. Welcome. Please, maybe only be 89 degrees every day.
Okay, and what song exactly were we listening to there?
That was Fresh Prince with DJ Jazzy Jeff, Summertime, perhaps the best song about summer ever written. Don't even fire back with anything like...
What was this? Summertime, the living is easy.
The living is not easy. It's too hot to be easy. It's too hot. No.
That's the only summertime I know.
But technically, it fits with our first film we're going to talk about today, which is Summerland. Summerland. Terrible transition. I would never just start Summerland with Summertime. That's so amateur. But it was hot this month. That's why I did it. Okay. Summerland. World War II. We're talking about World War II. As part of the war effort, if we remember, like Narnia, Lion, Witch, and the Wardrobe, the kids had to leave London. They had to leave London and go live in rural England. Here, Frank, little Frank, they never say his age. I'm guessing he's 10, 11, 12, Hannah? I don't know. Somewhere around there.
He goes south.
It looks like he goes to Dover, because those are the white cliffs of Dover that they're hanging out with. He moves in with Gemma Arterton. Hello. Love Gemma Arterton. He leaves London where it's unsafe, and he moves in with Gemma Arterton, who, Alice is her name. She does not like children. I think it's fair to say she hates children. She even enjoys tormenting children, and they torment her right back. She's this nose to the book, writing her academic treatises about folklore and women's roles in them. And she's so busy that she does not have time to take care of the war's leftovers. She just wants to be left alone. But of course, over the course of about 90 some minutes, her character will evolve. Maybe she and Frank will bond and everything will be tied up in a nice little bow. What do you think, Hannah?
Well, I think it took place at Kent was, I think, what the on-screen location said. So I'm pretty sure that's where we were at the
time.
That
would be north-northeast of Dover then.
Oh, okay. See, your geography is better. I just read what it says on the screen and go, lovely. Yeah. Oh, well, there you go. I've been to London. That's about it. So, yes, poor little Frank was... basically, you know, sent away because his parents were involved in the war effort. And so in order to make sure that he was protected during the war, he was sent to this town to really just be protected. And he gets stuck with Alice. And of course, you know, he's a little wary of her at the beginning too, just as she is of him. And it is your typical sort of standard kind of sentimental kind of journey where they will both learn from each other, and it has themes of love and friendship. And while the ending's a bit contrived, it will solve that yearning for a story that will evoke a little bit of a misty eye, I would say. So I liked it. I thought Gemma commands the screen. She just really does. She's on screen for, I would say, like 95% at least of this movie. And she's great, but there's not enough Gugu Mbatha Raw in there, who I just absolutely think is amazing as well. And so I kind of just, at the end of the film, I was like, oh, I just wish we had more Gugu. And I was a little lukewarm on the casting of the kid Frank. I thought maybe it might have, the film might have felt a little different if they had gone with a different character there.
I liked Frank. I thought he carried himself very well. The big secret to Summerland, the big reveal is why Alice hates children. Because at first you're like, what? Okay, fine. You live alone. You're a spinster in the parlance. You're not interested in, you know, any members of any sex. Okay, why do you hate children? Well, we come to learn why, and that's the big reveal. And okay, she earns it, I suppose. This was written and directed by Jessica Swale. She won an Olivier Award. That is Britain's Tony Award. She is a British playwright, a theater director, now screenwriter. And Gemma Arterton starred in her play, Neil Gwynn. So I guess that is why she is in her film as well. I loved the New York Times had a one-liner on their review, and it says, Summerland is a thumb to suck in troubled times. It's so well put, because it's, yes, there's conflict, but there's not like conflict. It takes place in World War II, but there's no war in this movie. The war is actually inside. It's inner turmoil. I could see exactly where this was going. When Frank shows up with his little suitcase and Alice is like, I don't want you here and you're only going to stay a week. I'm like, sure you are. Sure you're only going to stay a week, Frank. Why don't you settle in? You're not going anywhere. Right. There's lots of flashbacks. Yes, this place takes place in the 40s, but actually it starts in the 70s, and I think it flashes back to the 20s.
There's like a little flapper stuff.
it's shot on location. Looks like Kent, I guess. I think you used the word mysticism when we were talking earlier, and there is mysticism in it because she talks about some, not fables, but some of that Morgan Le Fay business, because I connect her with King Arthur legends and myths. I guess I'm looking for myths. There's some mythical mysticism going on, which is contrite and cute. This movie's very cute.
Well, but cute in an arty way as opposed to cute in a mainstream way, I think. It's very, you know, sensitive and sweet and you know, but I found there was another kid that I just wish they had Edie. I wish they had done more with her character. She's like this. She starts off as a total firecracker when Frank goes to sit next to her in school, and she basically ignores him. And she's like, "I'm an individualist, a maverick," and I loved Edie. And we sort of see Edie kind of comes and goes throughout this and has a bit of a pivotal friendship role ultimately with Frank. But I wanted more Edie, and I kind of felt like we sort of didn't get to wrap her up as well. I actually thought there was going to be a slight difference with the ending that maybe would have brought her back. But did not have more Edie. So yes, we needed more Edie, and we needed a little bit more of Ra's character. But beyond that, I mean, Gemma brings this one home. She's just watchable. And so no matter what you might think of the film as a whole, it's an easy watch. And right now that's the kind of entertainment that I think we can all use a little bit more of.
Yeah, usually I would, you know, you would find me chucking a spear at something that's an easy watch and took the easy way out. And how could you be so lazy? But no, I'm all for easy watches right now. Sign me up.
Unless it's the next film that we're going to talk about, which you would have that spear at the ready. You would have thrown it my way 10 times over, because it will remind anyone who really loves, like I did, Sweet Home Alabama, one of your most hated films of all time for some unknown reason.
We've gone into this. I'm not going to read it.
We have. So The Secret, Dare to Dream. So while Summerland has, you know, some deeper themes that and probably a lot more substance, The Secret, Dare to Dream still has some of those same elements of love and friendship. and that hint of something, of a belief in something bigger. And that's where I actually think these two films, both rated PG, both coming out at the same time, it was just kind of interesting to have watched both of those back to back. Anyone who was reading anything around 2006 probably got past a copy of the book, The Secret. I know I did. Did you ever read The Secret, Charlie?
Take a guess.
Probably not.
No.
And so I had gotten it from one of my more spiritual-minded friends, and it was this very popular self-help book by Rhonda Byrne, and I think she also had done a documentary at the time on this. And the idea is that you visualize your dreams and goals, and they're more likely to come true. Ugh. Now, you and I are both sort of, you know, we have that like a bit of a cynical and jaded streak going. And so that makes this film a little more difficult to swallow. But I also understand the appeal, especially right now when negativity seems to rule the day. And this film, The Secret, Dare to Dream, is ultimately a drama that's all about positivity. And even though it's a bit lame, I will call it, I give it what I like to call a kumbaya pass, where, you know, I get what it's going for. You got to embrace that and just sort of forgive the rest that you, Charlie, would not be able to forgive. I know that you're really excited to know that this film would essentially, I'd call it a mashup of a very cheesy Lifetime movie. So I know that's already got you interested. Pretty much any Nicholas Sparks movie, because they all take place near water and have some romance in them. And then you've got that hint of the classic romantic drama Sweet Home Alabama, because it has Josh Lucas in it, who was in both these films. And it was directed by the same guy who directed Sweet Home Alabama. So do you have any idea whatsoever, Charlie, what The Secret, Dare to Dream is actually about?
Just let me say, first of all, how happy I am, how thrilled I am that you have described and technically reviewed a film entirely based on what you, on my lens, on my view, my abhorrence of such a disgusting idea of a film. And I love everything about that. No, I don't know what it's about.
My whole thing is, if my description made you cringe, as I'm sure it did for you, then this is not the movie for you. This movie is really for practitioners of The Secret, or anybody that just really wants that reassurance.
The Secret was a fad. Is anyone still practicing The Secret?
I don't know. I think it's still out there, is like probably out there as a sort of one of those bestsellers that just kind of sits on a list for years and years and years. But there are people, I think, who believe in the power of believing in what The Secret is trying to say. And right now, especially, you know, it's getting this message across that we all have this power to transform our lives in fundamental ways. And so The Secret, Dare to Dream follows a young widow named Miranda, played by Katie Holmes. Hadn't seen her in a while. And she's struggling to make ends meet. She's got three good kids. She's got this very kind-hearted boyfriend and boss played by Jerry O'Connell. And, you know, but life is throwing her one curveball after another. She's broke. She needs a root canal. Then she gets into a fender bender. She has a leaky roof. And then one day there's this massive storm bearing down on the Louisiana Bayou, which is where this takes place. And a mysterious man named Bray, played by Josh Lucas, blows into town. And he's got this very philosophizing spirit of positivity that has this profound impact on Miranda and her kids. But he's harboring a bit of a secret, Charlie, and that could blow up everything. But you know it won't. So it's got this sappy soundtrack. It's superficial but sincere. And I don't know. I know you would hate it, but you just sort of have to say, okay, Katie Holmes and Josh Lucas and the director even, Andy Tennant, probably kind of were able to phone this one in. But as Bray would say, think about what you want instead of what you don't want. And so if you want, it's available to stream for $19.99 through a bunch of on-demand platforms.
I bet I bet it is. No, it does not sound sincere. It sounds the opposite of sincere. Nothing about that. It sounds cloying. It reminds me of when you reviewed Last Christmas and you kept saying, look up, look up. That's exactly what that review sounded like.
It is. That's what it's like. It is. It's very sweet and sappy, and it is essentially a Lifetime second chance movie. So people who've watched those know exactly what I'm talking about. And if you get, and there's Christmas movies on Lifetime. This is a film for the folks that actually do really enjoy sort of having a marathon viewing of those very easy to watch, easy breezy, means well, uplifting, ends on a positive message kind of film. And it gets amped up just a notch. Because you have a really good cast with Katie Holmes, Jerry O'Connell, and Josh Lucas. And so that sort of elevates it a little bit more. But it is, in essence, a slightly higher production value version of a Lifetime movie.
Ugh.
Moving on to something stronger, huh, Charlie? Go for it. What are our vegetables to watch this week?
Yes, life is negative right now. For pick your reason, we are living in the most cynical of times. However, not all of us are like you and me and just wrap ourselves in it and just somehow get out of bed in the morning. There are fighters who actually get out of bed and say, you know what? I see the problems and I'm going to do something about it. And the first documentary we're going to talk about is called The Fight, and it's about the ACLU. It actually follows four teams of ACLU attorneys as they battle the administration's attempts to gut laws on gender equality, immigration, abortion rights, and the census. And it's really good timing that this is coming out right now, the tail end of July, beginning of August, 3 months before the general election. Now, this came about where one of the directors, Elise Steinberg, she was at the Brooklyn courthouse when ACLU lawyer Lee Glernt won a stay against Trump's first atrocity when he first became president, which was the Muslim ban. And she was so moved. She was so hyped. She ran back to her partner, said, scrap the whiteboard, scrap the ideas. We're doing this. We're going to follow this. And it won a special jury award at this year's Sundance. And it also has a very well-known producer for you, though, for those of you who watch television, Kerry Washington, the Scandal. I've never seen Scandal, but I know her from Django Unchained and The Last King of Scotland. This trio's previous film, they did Wiener, if you remember that, in 2016. Mm-hmm. They followed Anthony Wiener's. He had already resigned from Congress, had already been shamed. And this was his, I'm running for New York City mayor. I'm going to atone for my sins. And it shows him get caught again. That was a great documentary. They filmed this over 3 years. I really enjoyed The Fight. It's probably in my top five documentaries of this year so far.
Yeah, and we saw this one at AFI Docs, the virtual AFI Docs, a few weeks back. And a bunch of those films, especially the really good ones, are rolling out right around now. They're just kind of spaced out over the next month or so. And so The Fight was definitely one of the strongest ones. And as I said, I think when we talked about it a few weeks ago, it really is, it feels a bit like a recruitment video for the ACLU, but it will have you thinking about reactivating your membership if you're not still a card-carrying member of the ACLU. I think my dad just mentioned that he re-upped, because even if you weren't necessarily over the course of the past 5-10 years feeling that you were aligned with what the ACLU lawyers were doing, this film will really help you appreciate how important it is. This organization's been around for about 100 years, and you're just reminded of the passion and the dedication of these lawyers who are really fighting the good fight. I personally would still probably recommend the John Lewis doc, Good Trouble, that's still out there, especially right now on the heels of his funeral and his message. But this is a good one, I think, to follow up on, because it really is doing exactly what John Lewis was asking. And it's like, keep fighting the good fight, get into trouble, good trouble. And I think these guys are still doing that every day. And I think that's going to be so important moving forward.
Yeah, I really hope this gets a little traction, gets word of mouth. Mm-hmm. It really deserves to be seen, but it's going to preach to the choir.
Right. Absolutely.
And
absolutely.
When already voting for certain sides, they're just not going to watch this movie. Mm-hmm. The second documentary we're going to talk about is called Rebuilding Paradise, and it's by a very well-known director, and it covers a very well-known event from 2018. Hannah, who directed Rebuilding Paradise?
I believe it was Ron Howard, who just always directs. His films are just always well-directed. He knows how to provide good pacing and find good characters. And I think a lot of people missed Pavarotti that he did last year. And I was like, it was a really good documentary. And so that's why, again, this was an AFI Docs documentary that I saw. And there was a Q&A with Ron Howard at the time that was very compelling. And so, yeah, Ron Howard, you know, having the chance to really to show people what it was like, what the 2018 campfire in the town of Paradise, California, what it did to, it just devastated this community and displaced over 50,000 residents, left so much of the town in ashes. But Ron Howard's documentary follows these, you know, a few select residents for about a year, just as you see them attempting to rebuild their homes, their lives, their communities. The fire images from cell phones and stuff was just phenomenal to watch. And so it's just, you know, it's just one of those kind of conventional documentaries, but very well done and an interesting story.
Yeah, the first part is really about the fire. You're watching, you know, it's the middle of the day, but it's pitch black, and you're watching the small town of Paradise, California, burn to the ground. And those are very riveting cell phone images. You're pretty sure everyone taking the videos, they're just going to die. But the second half of the film is where it's okay. You know, yes, they're rebuilding, but it's really about the bureaucracy of starting over. You're seeing them, you know, bicker in town hall meetings about how they want to proceed, how they want to rebuild houses, and what forms to fill out. It's brought to us by National Geographic Films, and it's got a National Geographic sort of feel to it. And just like The Fight, it world premiered at this year's Sundance Film Festival, so there's a connection. Yeah, I don't like it as much as The Fight, but you know, for it's more for nature people, I guess, nature lovers. Yeah,
I would agree. And so, you know, I think it's, the thing is, it's ultimately meant to be this tribute, to serve as a tribute to the resilience and community in the face of uncertainty. And I think we can all relate to that right now. And I remember just thinking as I was watching it with these kids who were finally able to go back to school after their schools had to be rebuilt and so many people were not able to come back. I'm like, wow, these same kids to have to go through, you know, the uncertainty of the coronavirus and whether or not they can go back to school. Like, they've just been hit by a double whammy, because we're really, we're not that far removed from November of 2018. And so it's been a rough couple of years for these kids, and I think, and for that community. And so I think the message now that Ron Howard probably, he would never have even imagined how powerful it might be 2 years later, that it really is just saying, hey, you know, we're all in this together, and it's going to take everybody together to get through it.
All right, our final film is also a documentary, but it's actually a documentary short, and usually that just means 40 minutes or less, and this comes in right about the 40-minute mark. So while you, Hannah, watched The Secret, I watched Speed Cubers. Speed Cubers. Did you play with Rubik's Cube growing up, or maybe you still do?
I still do. I actually, when I heard that you had watched that one, which I've not seen yet, I actually pulled out my old Rubik's Cube. So you probably can't tell, but I'm playing with it right now.
Yeah, I think we had one in the house growing up, but I never really latched onto it. I never learned how to solve it, because, you know, I just get too frustrated if I have to take so much time to learn how to do something properly. But The Speed Cubers is a documentary on the lives of speed cubing champions. The film premiered this week on Netflix on Wednesday. And all right, here's some trivia. You're going to wow your friends if you're listening to this podcast. The Rubik's Cube was invented in 1974 by Hungarian professor of architecture Erno Rubik.
Okay, I think I did know that in the late 70s, but I'm glad to be reminded, because I had forgotten.
You never. This is hip pocket information. You're going to use this at some time in your lives, folks. You meet the premier of the sport and their teenagers. You meet Felix Zemdegs. He's Australian, and he held all the world records. 3x3, 4x4. You're going to learn all about the subcategories of speed cubing. But then American Max Park shows up on the scene. And Max is a little different. He is not the standard speed cuber. He's autistic. And actually, the Rubik's Cube helped bring him out of his shell. He learned to interact with other people, be able to express his emotions. And it's while yes, this is about a particular world speed cubing championship, it's actually more about the relationship between Felix and Max. Max idolized Felix. He grew up, you know, watching his YouTube videos of speed cubing, and Felix kind of, you know, takes him under his wing. Doesn't really mind as Max shatters all of his world records. And really, the Speed Cubers reminded me of some of those Spelling Bee documentaries we've been watching, mm-hmm. or those crossword puzzle documentaries. It's about, you know, an obsessive subculture of human that just coalesce about one particular, what some would consider a hobby, some would consider a sport. And the director here, Sue Kim, made a very wise choice to make this 40 minutes. Yes, she could have made this 90 minutes and done the film festival circuit. It wouldn't have worked. It's not a 90-minute film. This is a perfectly wrapped 40-minute film. I got it. I now understand speed cubing. I know where it was. I know where it is. Found the two most interesting people. Wrap it up. Call it good. Too easy. 40 minutes.
That's excellent. I'm glad because, you know, when you mentioned it, I did pull out my Rubik's Cube and I was really disappointed that I do not remember, like I don't have the muscle memory to solve it. And I really thought I'd be able to. So now I'm just going to, I'm going to have to watch the short and figure out if I'm clued in to remember exactly how I go about getting my Rubik's Cube solved, since I do have it.
I mean, imagine it would take you however long to solve the one that's in your hands right now. These kids can do it in 6 seconds. They can solve it in 6 seconds. It's nauseating to see. Just, oh my God.
I'm just amazed that it's still out there because it's like, to me, it's a retro stress reliever. You know, you just sort of put it in your hands and you play with it. But I remember we were all able to solve it. Once you figured it out, you were able to solve it pretty quick. Certainly not for me in 6 seconds, more like 30. But now I am determined. I will give it another go.
I hope you do. Let it update us next week. I want a progress report. I want to highlight another show I've been watching. If you're familiar with Last Chance U, this is a Netflix show. They have just released the other day, season 5. Now, these are all self-contained seasons. You don't need to start with 1, 2, 3, 4. Last Chance U is about junior college football. So these are high school players that were not good enough for Division I, or were in Division I and something happened. Someone made a bad choice and now they're in junior college. And they're all they want is, the dream is a Division I scholarship. And these, you know, the first season was in Scuba, Mississippi, way down south. And it's just with a sociopath coach. Now we're in Oakland. And these are very disadvantaged kids. So each episode is really about one kid or the coach or the town of Oakland. And each episode also is about one game of the season. And now that it's season 5, they have really hit their stride. They know how to run an episode, how to edit an episode to really grab my attention. I haven't finished the season yet, but I'm enthralled. Please, folks, if you're into sports, if you're into football or even the sociology of it, even if you don't like sports, but you're interested in the sociology of junior college and what youth do nowadays to try to achieve their goals, Last Chance U is fascinating viewing, Hannah. I love this show.
All right. No, I have not been very good about trying to find any kind of series just because by the time I get through all of the regular old films to watch, I really have not seen much else, but that does sound like an interesting show. So I would probably give Last Chance U a chance if I have a chance to watch.
Well, this is not a homework assignment, but looking ahead, I want to clue folks into what I'm going to watch this week. So maybe you can join us and you can get in on the conversation. Just today on Disney Plus, a new version of The Muppet Show premiered. It's called Muppets Now. And I haven't seen any trailers for it. I don't know anything about it. But what I believe it is a reinvention of the Muppet talk show. So, you know, there's one celebrity guest and there's skits. And I'm really excited to introduce my seven-year-old to it. You know, he has no idea that there used to be a Muppet show back in the 70s. He knows of the Muppet Babies, you know, that cartoon. But you know, he doesn't know that, you know, Kermit and Scooter and the gang used to run a television show and horrible things would happen with the celebrity host and hijinks would ensue. And I think they're reinventing that. And this week's not challenge, not homework, but opportunity. We'll call it opportunity to join with the Clash. I am going to dive into Muppets now.
I will dive into Muppets now because I loved watching the Muppets. And I want to just find out if the two old geezers in the balcony are still alive because they've got to be about 130 now.
Do you know their names?
I don't.
That is Statler and Waldorf.
They were great, and I want to see if they sang Phenomenon, dun, 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 dun. So, Phenomenon. You know, exactly. So I'm kind of excited to check that one out again. It's a lot of retro stuff. See, it's retro for me, and it's new for you.
Rubik's Cube and The Muppet Show are not new for me, but let's just say, I wasn't there on their first run. I was not.
That's right.
I wasn't there.
It provides a new opportunity for sharing with a new generation, which I think will be great. So I look forward to seeing what your kid thinks of it and what you think of it. And I really am just kind of curious about the guys in the balcony. So if they're in there, then I'm just going to be very excited for.
Please, Cinema Clash listeners, play along. I want to know, like, if this is a terrible idea that we're jumping into, being we're just going in because we're ignorant, we don't know anything about it, and it's not what we think, or this is it. We latched on, and Muppets Now is the new cog of the zeitgeist.
Well, and I guess if you got Disney Plus for Hamilton, and it's still and you still got it there, and you ordered it for however long, then this is, I think, a really good opportunity. How lucky if you just happen to just sort of roll into the next month with Disney Plus and you're like, well, I can watch Hamilton a few hundred more times and I get to check out this new Muppet show. So it's a win-win.
All right. Now the next thing is to watch the Muppets perform Hamilton and it all comes together.
There you go. So I think that's a good place to leave it. I'm going to go try and solve my Rubik's Cube now. Hopefully I'll have it figured out by next week. Till then. Thank you so much for listening to the Cinema Clash. Stay safe, wash your hands, don't pass around the same Rubik's Cube, and please wear a mask.
Will do.
The Cinema Clash with Charlie Jewell and Hannah Buchdahl is heard twice each weekend at 5:15 on Saturday and 12:15 on Sunday afternoon. Join us again next time for The Cinema Clash.